This passage challenges me, so I just want to say that before I dive in, I find this one difficult. It makes me confront whatever, whatever wavering line separates what is figurative and what is literal in the Bible. And I'll admit that I have questions about the reality and ethics of a beggar man being healed. But that makes me also wonder why I don't have as many questions about Jesus rising from the dead. Makes you think. The Bible is full of instances of the seemingly unreal or divine mysteries. And I want to share some things that I notice in the text. I like to play a game of noticing, which feels like a very Lydian place to start. I notice here in verse 2 that the man is the subject of the sentence. Quote, "Now a man who was lame from birth." I also notice that the construction of that sentence with my editor hat on is the passive tense, not active. The man was being carried. For me, that's a little awkward in the mouth. Was being carried, not something I maybe often say or hear, which makes me confront the limitations, I think, of our ableist language. In this translation, the man is the subject, but grammatically, he feels slighted. A more active phrasing, active tense, might be a group of people carried a man. But in that translation, the man isn't the subject. It's a group of people. And so something in that felt a little fuzzy or strange to me, because it's true that this man lives, this beggar man lives in a specific state of interdependence. We all do. But sometimes that state is more visible for others. Nonetheless, I can't help but feel that the man is being used as a prop in the text, if we're to take it in a literal sense. Like so many on the fringes in the Bible, this man does not have a name. He becomes reduced to an example, someone who Peter and John can use to highlight the resurrection of Jesus. They have these words they share that I would say come with an asterisk, which is good intentions. Somehow there is the power to cure a person, but not the power to better infrastructure or policies that would increase accessibility without homogenizing a person's body. And that's where I paused when I read this the first time, knowing I'd be looking at it today, and where I considered something I hadn't before, because I read this, and I thought about it, and I wanted to practice critical thinking, and maybe this is not new to anybody here, but it was new to me in that moment, which maybe makes it new, because I'm sharing it with all of you for the first time here, which is that humans wrote this text. And metaphors, which straddle the figurative and the literal, are extremely hard to compose. Metaphors are imperfect because metaphors are approximations. And at the same time, I've also heard metaphors gorgeously spun that capture more than the concrete can. I want to give a recent example, and it's a little strange. My husband Sam has a friend named Sam who lives far away. He's somebody who has maybe sometimes in parts of his life been a little stalled or stilted and vivacious and traveled. But in this chapter, he finds himself living back at home in Wyoming. And Sam wrote a letter. Sam's friend Sam wrote a letter sharing a bit of a strange episode at like a bar or a restaurant. He was there with some people chatting, and a man, I guess nearby, gets up on a table with a noose around his neck and says, or screams, all right, before I do this, I've got some things I gotta say. And Sam's friend Sam turns to his neighbors and said, I gotta pee, I'll be right back. And I found that very, very funny, or morbidly so, like this dark humor, kind of this anti-climax, like, wait, hold on, what's this person gonna do and you're gonna go urinate? But in the letter, Sam's friend wrote, when the man stood on the table, Sam's friend said, it's not like I really had to pee that badly, but it's like when you're at a karaoke bar and someone sings a song that's already been played. I've heard this one before. And when he shared that letter, I thought his friend navigated metaphor in a really deft, clever, touching way, because what I took from it was he was saying something about his own mental health without saying the thing about his own mental health. And those words and how they were crafted and delivered to me put me under some kind of spell and put me in like a different headspace or space of realization and access point to this person's need and self-awareness. And I will admit to you that when I read about the unnamed man in Acts 3, I don't feel like I'm under that spell. And I think that's because the man at the subject has little agency. He doesn't ask to be healed, and the story is not from his point of view. Something about that as a reader personally detaches me from it, which made me then wonder about my belief in the resurrection. And I believe that Jesus rose from the dead, not just because it is a centerpiece of Christianity that I've been fed and fed to the point of it being unimpeachable, but because I believe what the act signifies, that love and forgiveness and selflessness are stronger than the self-hate, lack of critical thinking, and tribalism that led to the crucifixion. That love, forgiveness, and selflessness are also qualities that are key to our mutual interdependence, even though they can be harder to practice and slower in execution. But I believe it. And I also believe the author of today's stories wanted to show that. I don't think this story, this that we read tonight, would like kill at an open mic. But it does remind me that it reminds me of the human behind the writing and the desire to communicate something grander about our bodies and how their internal goodness can radiate out. Maybe the unnamed man's already did. We just weren't given that context. And we live in a superficial, ableist world. The temple gate in this passage is called Beautiful. I can't help but think of one of my favorite books, the memoir, I meant to bring it with me to show, I forgot it, the memoir Easy Beauty by Chloe Cooper Jones. Chloe's a writer, a philosopher, a teacher, and her title, Easy Beauty, refers to a theory by some older philosopher named Bernard Bosquet, which basically says that there is easy beauty, that which society deems easy to behold, unquestioned. And then there's hard beauty, which takes more time to appreciate because of preconceived notions. Chloe, who is disabled, opens her book with, I am at a bar in Brooklyn listening as two men, my friends, discuss whether or not my life is worth living. Chloe comes to decide she will not hold the pain others put on her body. It's a deep resolution, and one that comes alive through the figurative and the literal, imagining and writing.